Welcome to Issues and Ideas. I'm Larry Rutter. This week, we're going to talk about some pleasant surprises.
After going through the last 4 years of anguish and strife with the state economy and our accreditation challenges and so on, we were just starting to dig our way out of that when suddenly we got a phone call from a local Morro Bay attorney.
And we're going to talk about some big ideas.
We are looking to tackle some of the biggest public policy challenges in the state of California, but doing it a little bit differently.
And we're going to visit a wacky, tiny town in Texas.
Tuna prides itself on these huge Christmas yard displays that they do, and there's a contest every year that has been won by the same character, Vera Carr, for 15 years in a row. So there's some people that are trying to undo her record.
But also this week on Issues and Ideas, we're going to begin on not a very felicitous note. In the aftermath of a massive typhoon that hit the Philippines almost 2 weeks ago, winds were as high as 200 miles an hour. The death toll is said to be at least 4,000, and millions are homeless. People and governments around the world are mobilizing to help. So are people locally. I have a couple guests with me in the studio on a mission to help send some aid to typhoon-ravaged Philippines. They are Rick Lendon, who's United Way's CEO, and Erica Stewart, their chief operating officer. Both Rick and Erica, welcome to KCBX.
Thank you.
Thanks, Larry. Nice to be here.
Yesterday morning on National Public Radio, NPR, I heard that there were 4 million homeless in the Philippines. What do we know about the extent of devastation? What do you hear from your people?
Well, from my understanding, there is a lot of devastation right now as far as homes, as far as food, as far as illness. And what we're sending over aid for is the immediate needs. Long term, though, we're also adding financial assistance so that we can help them rebuild, recover, and bring back their economy.
And this is an effort of United Way, local United Way organizations throughout the country, throughout the world?
Throughout the world. There's actually 1,800 United Ways throughout the world. There's United Way of Philippines, which we're affiliated with. And we are all together once something happens, whether it's the Oklahoma tornadoes, whether it's the Philippines, whether it's Hurricane Katrina. When the immediate needs happen, we build together, all 1,800 of us, and try to help.
And how does that work?
As soon as an emergency happens, our national, worldwide, they immediately let everyone know, as far as all of the different United Ways, here's the way we're opening, reactivating the building fund, and here's what's happening. They send us updates. They send us bulletins of what's happening actually there, because they have boots on the ground. They have people literally in the situation.
And these are United Way volunteers that
Correct.
Are actually going to the Philippines
Correct.
Or in the Philippines right now?
Correct. There's United Way volunteers there right now, staff there right now. And then, of course, when people see a disaster, they want to come help. So they call their United Way and say, how can I help? And that's how we can get people there as well.
And so if people locally are interested in physically helping, they can do it, at least the United Way can act as a conduit for that to happen?
Correct. They can. Go ahead.
Well, right now I would say the Red Cross has got the lead on that.
Definitely.
They're a first responder. One of the ways that when the United Way Worldwide activated the Disaster Relief Fund for the Philippines, for example, United Way of Southern Louisiana – really connected with that more than other United Ways because of what they learned with Katrina. Mm-hmm. So we've learned a lot. There were lessons learned by United Way in Oklahoma from the tornadoes, lessons learned in New York from Sandy, things like this. But generally, first responders get involved, like the Red Cross. There's actually it can get complicated when spontaneous, unaffiliated volunteers try to go help and they really don't know. They're not trained. So that could be difficult. And we're actually not trying to compete with the Red Cross. But what happens is after the initial heart force that drives people and money to these disaster areas wears off, sort of the honeymoon, so to speak, fades away, there's a tremendous amount of work that's still required. And the United Way movement is focused on education, income, and health, helping youth achieve their potential, helping families become financially stable, and improving people's health. And we have a hard time doing that without a disaster. Our societies are challenged. Without disasters, helping our youth do better, we have so many families that aren't financially stable in the United States, for God's sakes. Mm-hmm. If you can imagine what's going on in the Philippines, it's absolutely horrific. And when you say 4 million people, that's actually 4% of their population. So it is it's a unimaginable tragedy.
Mm-hmm. What are you hearing about beside the homeless and whatnot? What about disease and what about some of the other things that come with homelessness and come with the disasters? What are you hearing about that?
Well, I don't know that we are. United Way of San Luis Obispo County isn't as in tuned with what's going on in the Philippines, as say the United Way in Louisiana. Our motivation is to help our county become familiar with the opportunities to help in areas around the world. Our local office got a presentation from our local Red Cross yesterday. So this is in the forefront of my mind, but about almost half the money that was raised for the tsunami in Japan, half of those donations came from donors in the United States. So United Way of San Luis Obispo County wanted to help local residents who were interested in helping the Philippines, that they would be aware that United Way Worldwide is a vehicle for funding that. By the way, any donations that come to United Way of San Luis Obispo County designated to the Philippines disaster relief, our United Way takes no percentage of that. That money goes 100% to United Way Worldwide, and they take 5%, to help administer the fund. So 95% of those funds go directly to the Philippines. As far as one disease that we can mention, United Way of the Philippines, which is actually the Philippines Business for Social Progress Group. There's about 230 organizations involved in that, and that group is an affiliate with United Way Worldwide. They've done a lot of work to help mitigate tuberculosis, which is a big issue, more so in the Philippines than here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. If someone locally would like to participate through the United Way, believe in the whole idea and would like to do that, how can they do it? What's the mechanism for doing that?
Well, we have the website, which is unitedway.org/Philippines, and that is directly sending the funds to the Philippines. Or you can contact us and we can get you connected with one of the partner agencies that we work with.
And Rick, you made the point that none of the money sticks here. If X number of dollars come in, it's X number of dollars that go out to the Philippines if it's earmarked for the Philippines.
Yes, and you could go to unitedwayslo.org. We have a link for you to get you to the Disaster Relief Fund. Or you can call us at 541-1234. You can send us the money, and we'll forward the money directly.
Now, what about your general United Way fund? Do you have any discretionary money in there that you might be using for the Philippines or that could be directed in that direction? Or is this more the national, international United Way effort?
I would say more of the United Way worldwide effort. Our board approved discretionary funding to Katrina years ago. But generally, what's raised here stays here. Our money stays here locally because we have our own issues that we're dealing with. So we take care of that. I'd like to mention the United Way in Korea, South Korea, which is known as the Community Chest of Korea, allocated $1 million to the recovery effort in the Philippines. So that's that's the kind of things our worldwide movement is doing. We're actually in 41 countries And we're all advocating for a focus on education, income, and health. Mm-hmm. So we're very preventative, self-responsible oriented. And that means, like, we would like the three little pigs. We're trying to get people to think bricks instead of straw kind of thing. And when it comes to tornadoes and wind, bricks is way better than straw.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we run out of time here, but I want to repeat again, Erica, I want to make a contribution through United Way. How do I do that?
Thank you. You go to UnitedWaySLO.org, and we have a link that goes directly to the Philippines.
And you can do it like with a credit card or something like that?
You can do it through cash. You can come to our office. We're located right downtown on Morrow Street at 1288 Morrow Street. You can call us at 541-1234 and let us know how we can help you donate.
Absolutely. That's terrific. Erica Stewart, the Chief Operating Officer, and Rick London, the CEO of United Way San Luis Obispo County. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to visit with us today.
Thanks,
Larry. Thank you for having us.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Coming up a little later in the program, we'll hear about some delightful holiday entertainment being offered by one of our venerable local theater companies. But now, a good news story. In just about every aspect and level of education today, there seems to be a dearth of good news. So when it seems like good things are happening, we should celebrate. And so I've invited a celebrant back into the KCBX studio. Smiling guest, introduce yourself, please.
Well, thank you, Larry. my name is Gil Stork, and I'm the president of Cuesta College.
We've talked with you a couple of times over the past few years, and the topics we covered had to do with failed attempts at accreditation and falling state revenue, and kind of grim but very necessary discussions. Everything is not perfect these days, but you have had some what I think are really nice things happen to Cuesta College, and I wanted to make sure our listeners knew about it and you got a chance to brag about it. First of all, you just recently got a grant for $1 million.
Yes. Matter of fact, about 3 weeks ago, we were notified by the trustees of an estate up in North County that we were left a little over $1 million by a wonderful woman by the name of Bertha Schultz, who had an estate worth a little over $4 million. And she divided that into several smaller gifts, $100,000 to $250,000, and three large gifts, a little over $1 million, to the Atascadero Fire Department, Morro Bay Fire Department, and the Cuesta College North County Children's Center for facility development. Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing. Had she had a relationship with the North County campus or Cuesta?
Well, no. The only record we had of a contact with her was noted in a file of 1996, where she was contacted as a potential donor, and there was a recorded notes of the conversation that took place, but really no history of donations on a regular basis. But she was kind of an under-the-radar type of person who had a close relationship with the Atascadero Fire Department and Morro Bay Fire Departments, and used to attend, go by the stations regularly. The Atascadero Fire Department even named one of the fire trucks Big Bertha in her honor, and actually gave her a ride in the fire truck. And it was a wonderful story. Huh. But she had a great interest in children, and she had a great interest in education and service to mankind. And so in her infinite wisdom, she was sorting out how she wanted to impact the lives of citizens, one from a public safety standpoint and one from the standpoint of helping young students who had school-aged children or preschoolers to be able to go back to school and have child care for them, or also have a facility that would train future child care providers. So it was a great great vision on her part to be able to think of that. And so we had a press conference last Friday up in the North County campus, and we had two big fire trucks there. We had all the kids from the child care center there, and they were all enamored with the fire trucks and got their pictures taken. So if you go on the Cuesta College website, cuesta.edu, on our rolling pictures, you'll see the fire trucks and the kids and so on of that event. So it was just really marvelous.
And her bequest was for a building, is that right, or for ongoing operation?
Yeah. See, currently our child care center is in a portable building, which our original campus in the North County are modular buildings.
Right.
We have two permanent buildings, and we have a permanent child care center on the drawing board for a future building. But we're going to have to be taking down that modular building in the next couple of years. So unless we receive some state funding or go after a bond issue where we can build additional buildings, we'll need that $1 million to help create a new environment for the child care center. So the timing is absolutely tremendous. If we get funding from another source, then we can use that $1 million for upkeep and maintenance and repair on the building.
How many people make use of your child care now?
Well, it's full.
Yeah,
it's,
what does that mean?
Well, we have currently between the toddlers and the preschool age, I think we have about 25 to 30 student kids up there. And it's used both for child care, for students and staff. And if there are additional openings, it can be open to the community. But the priority are for students with children and staff with children. Then it's also a lab for our child development program. So our students who are training to become child care providers, that's the lab they work in to get the practical experience.
And this center, it will continue in operation until you get the other one built.
Absolutely.
Is it your anticipation that the other center will have more than 20 slots?
Yeah, and it depends on the demand. You know, as our student population grows, you know, as we're able to broaden our program again, that we want to be able to accommodate as many students as we can. I'm not sure exactly what the design capacity will be for that program. It also depends on the number of hours per day. We also have in the SLO campus, we also have a contract with Head Start. So we'd have some of Head Start program kids on our site. And they also use it on the weekend, too. So,
Very interesting. So
it's great.
Gil Stork, president of Cuesta College, is our guest here in the studio with us. All right. That was a $1 million grant, or bequest. You, a couple months ago, received a much larger bequest for a different purpose.
You want to hear about that?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you know, after going through the last 4 years of anguish and strife with the state economy and our accreditation challenges and so on, we were just starting to dig our way out of that when suddenly we got a phone call from a local Morro Bay attorney who is a co-trustee of another estate of a little-known family to the college who had built an estate worth around $13 million, and two-thirds of that estate was earmarked to support Cuesta College in the form of scholarships. And that came out of the clear blue sky, about $8.5 million worth. We received most of that gift. Some of it is still tied up in property, which is currently being sold in Morro Bay. And so we'll fully realize that full gift probably in the next eight months.
And this is supposed to be a self-sustaining program, is that correct?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, yeah, and the donor did not earmark it for an endowment. So basically what the foundation could do is just dole out the money until the $8.5 million is spent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the foundation board of directors, obviously, and with my conversation, we really didn't think that was a very wise use of that money. So they quasi-endowed the money, and that means that they created an endowment, which means that they could also unendow it if they needed any of the corpus or principal of that gift. They could take it out at any time. But the intent is to fully endow that $8.5 million gift, which will generate anywhere from $300,000 to $350,000 a year, which is the money that we'll use to fund our new scholarship program, which we're calling the Promise Program.
And how's that going to work?
Oh, that's going to work great. You want to hear?
Sure.
Well, about 4 years ago, I was on an accreditation visit to another college and heard about a program their foundation was doing, and they called it the Promise Program, which is a pretty common term for this type of a program. And I thought, wow, what a wonderful gift and what a wonderful thought that we can provide opportunities for students to get a start at a college, especially those students who maybe see that college is really not a possibility because of financial reasons. It could be the number of kids in the family, or it could just be first-generation college students where the family really isn't in tune with what it takes to go to to college. And we don't want any of that kind of barrier to prevent somebody from trying college. So I explained this concept to our executive director of our foundation when she came on board 2 years ago. I said, someday I'd really like to have a promise program, you know. So about 5 months ago, she walked in the office and said, I think we can deliver the promise. And I said, what are you talking about? So then she told me about the contact from the attorney and this gift from the Duvica family, which is a couple that was in Morro Bay. And the husband, Charles, had died a few years ago. And then Lita, the remaining spouse, had worked out the final conditions of her will and named Cuesta College as the recipient of this gift. And really the only stipulation was scholarships. So we had a lot of latitude as to how we should deliver this gift. And so I made a proposal to our foundation board, and I said, I'd really like to deliver the promise. And they bought it. That was great. And so then I put together a task force of staff who would be involved in actually operationalizing the concept. And we worked through it for a few months in this early fall, anticipating that we wanted to roll it out in time to prepare students for fall of 2014. So the way it works is that any high school graduate from San Luis Obispo County, whether it be a public high school, private high school, charter school, homeschooler, GED completer, who finishes during the 13-14 year and attends Cuesta College in the fall of 2014 would be eligible for the promise, as long as they meet all of the requirements that it takes to go through that process, which are really requirements that we would want every student to do who wants to be successful. You know, so there's a seven-step process, and the application period started November 1st. And so what the students have to do is they have to, number one, fill out a college application like every student does. They also have to fill out and complete a scholarship application, since this is a scholarship. But more importantly, it also puts them into the hopper for other possible scholarships that they may be eligible for to help offset cost of books or transportation or other expenses. Then they have to do an online orientation, and they have to fill out the federal financial aid application. Because many of these students will qualify for additional aid through either the federal source or for a Board of Governors, which is the California Board of Governors fee waiver program. So we want to plug them into all the avenues that can give them financial assistance. So whatever they can garner from these other sources, we apply those first, and then whatever fees that aren't covered, then the promise comes in and kicks in and takes up the rest of it. So when all the smoke clears, all of those students that I've just defined all receive the same benefit. Okay. Then they complete a student education plan, which is really their blueprint of how they get started and the courses they take after they've done their assessment in math and English, so we know what level they should start at. And then they register for classes. And if they do that all, if they complete everything except for the registration of classes by March 2nd, then they're in the hopper to receive the aid. And what that buys for them, it takes care of all the fees that we would normally charge every student. The biggest one, of course, is the enrollment fee, which currently is $46 a unit. So depending upon the number of units they take, a full-time student has to be at 12 or more units. So, and many of our first-time high school graduate students, many of them have to be full-time because they either have to be full-time to be covered on car insurance or medical insurance in their families. So we know a lot of students have to be at that level. It also covers the health fee, which is $17 a semester. The student body activity fee card, which is $10. We have a student rep fee, which every student is charged $1, and that money goes into helping our student government deal with advocacy issues with the legislature. And there's also a student center fee, which is $10 a semester, which goes to help pay back and improve the student center where all the activities and programs are. So the worth of that, if they're a 12-unit student, is around a $700 package that each student would be eligible for.
Made possible by the Duvica family.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We're talking with Gil Stork, president of Cuesta College, and basically we're talking good news, I guess. Change the subject.
Yeah.
It is my impression that the Cuesta Performing Arts Center, first of all, is a delightful structure. It is if you haven't been there, it's in the whatever's going on is of interest to you, you will enjoy yourself. I just can't emphasize that too much. But it seemed to me that you're getting a lot more activity at that Performing Arts Center this year than you've had in previous years. And it's been up and running for at least 3 or 4 years, it seems to me. It seems to be catching on. Am I got it right?
Yes. Actually, it opened up in late fall of 2009. So really our first full semester of operation was the spring of 2010. So we're in the third, finishing the third. You're actually almost approaching 4 years of activity. Because actually, when I came back as the president in January 2010, we held our opening convocation in the theater building to introduce everybody to the theater. So that was how new it was at that point. And we want people to understand that this is the Cultural and Performing Arts Center. That's why we call it the CPAC, as CPAC, to distinguish it from the PAC, which is the, on the Cal Poly campus. The theaters for California Community Colleges are built in such a way to accommodate audiences from 400 to 600 people. They're designed to be teaching stations. And a performing arts center secondarily. So it's a wonderful learning and teaching environment for our performing arts program, both in music and drama and instrumental as well as vocal music and dance also. So that's our first priority, expanding it out to other users from the community or from putting on hosting performers coming in from the outside takes a whole nother structure of staffing, which we have not been able to implement. It's been a priority, but going through this budget process we've been through for the last 4 years, we've never really been able to deliver the staffing that's required to go to that next step. So we're having to do this very carefully so that we don't, number one, leave a bad impression on any performing group, nor do we not, or that we don't take care of our audiences and make sure the ticketing and all the other support venues are okay. We are the home base for the Festival Mosaic, so that's their home field now. So they do two summer concerts there along with the ones they do throughout the community. But that's their home base. That's our first outside permanent user. But we're now starting to get other community groups that are starting to use the facility. But we're doing it very strategically so that we can make sure that we can support it, support the audience that attends. But we need, you know, we need permanent staffing for the ticketing process. We need a theater manager to be able to overrun that, whether that's a district-supported position or whether it's supported by revenues from attracting outside groups and the ticket sales for those. That's that fine balance. But we're working on that strategy of how to make this a more functioning, usable venue for wonderful groups. Everybody that performs there can't say enough about the quality of the structure, from the sound, the lighting, the audience, the venue in terms of the compactness and the feel like you're really in a big auditorium, but it's basically small. So we're really excited about it, and it's been a wonderful teaching facility for us. So.
Well, it seems to be, in my purview, getting more and more activity going on there, and very interesting stuff.
Yeah, we're starting to have standing room only crowds. Our first actual jam-packed event was our Book of the Year presentation last year. We have a Book of the Year program that we do. We select a book,
right,
and then it becomes a project for everybody reading it, and then we bring the author on campus, and they do a presentation, book signing. And last year it was The Language of Flowers.
Oh, yes.
And so that got running through the community with all the book clubs and so on, and the author came. And so we opened it up for the venue in the evening. It was a free presentation. Well, we had every single seat filled. And we have another one scheduled for April 3rd coming up, another Book of the Year. This is the Orange is the New Black.
Yeah, Orange is the New Black, and the name escapes me of the author. But
she'll be here to again, make a presentation. So we're anticipating another great event.
Quickly running out of time, but yeah. I did want to ask you about – the less felicitous topic, which is accreditation. Where does that stand right now?
Okay. Well, if you remember a year ago, February, we were put on show cause, right. which is a level you don't want to be on, meaning that the college has not responded adequately to be in compliance or that you've run out of time. And so we worked really hard during that 2012-13 year. And last February, we were removed from show cause and placed on warning, which is the least severe sanction, because we hadn't had time to finish our cycle of implementing our integrated planning process and assessing it. Well, so this year we just on November 5th we had a visit from the commission. We had a 2-member team come and visit us. They reviewed all the documents, did a lot of interviews, and their parting comments were, "We can't speak for the commission, who will meet in January, but we are so impressed with what you've done that we see that you know there should be little doubt in your mind that you have now been fully complied." Well, you know, I never get too excited till I see the action letter, but I do feel really confident that we have, in fact, done exactly what we were supposed to do. And I think we've become a model college of how you can respond to something as severe as show cause and change the culture of a college and get people on board and move forward, all united to be the best you can be. And I think we have surfaced back into the center of excellence, which is where we should be.
What a way to end. Gil Stork, president of Cuesta College, I want to thank you very much for visiting with us this afternoon.
Well, Larry, it's always a pleasure, and thank you very much.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX. I'm your host this week, Larry Rutter. In a few minutes, we'll have a chance to answer the question many have been asking. Whatever happened to Senator Sam Blakesley? The latest offering of the Pewter Plow Playhouse opens this weekend and runs through New Year's Eve. The play is called A Tuna Christmas. Its director, Jill Turnbow, joins me on the phone. Welcome, Jill.
Hello, how are you?
We're just fine. And the title of that play, I hear an echo of another well-known and well-received play.
Yes. It started with Greater Tuna, which I hope a lot of people are familiar with, which ran for years and years and years. And Greater Tuna has sort of spawned a franchise. And there's now 4 tuna shows.
Oh.
There's A Tuna Christmas, there's Red, White, and Tuna, and Tuna Goes to Vegas. So we are doing the Christmas show.
And what's the concept here?
Well, the concept is it's a two-man show. Two men play all the colorful characters in a small, it's the third smallest town in Texas. A completely mythical town called Tuna, and it's a little backwards and very Texan. And so kind of the beauty of the show is these two men play all these characters. It's got some very fast scene changes and costume changes, and they play women and kids and older people, and it's really fun.
And it has sort of a holiday theme, a Christmas theme?
This one does. Tuna Christmas, it's sort of the running theme is there's someone, the Christmas Phantom, who you don't find out until the end who that might be, is just terrorizing the town by messing up people's yard display. And Tuna prides itself on these huge Christmas yard displays that they do, and there's a contest every year that has been won by the same character, Vera Carr, for 15 years in a row. So there's some people that are trying to undo her record, so to speak. But a lot of it is just in the crazy characters and, you know, the relationships between these characters and, you know, meanwhile, they're trying to turn the lights off on the holiday play because they haven't paid their light bill. So there's a lot of little things kind of going on, but mainly it does focus on the Christmas Phantom and you trying to figure out who that might be.
Where do you find a couple of actors that can handle this kind of diversity?
Well, that was not easy. That was the hardest part about it. I did scour the county. A lot of people just were unavailable. They were all doing shows, but I did find 2 great actors. One of them, a very dear friend of mine who's a tremendous, tremendous actor. He comes up here every day from Arroyo Grande.
Oh, my gosh.
To do this role because it's just a role that he loves, and he loves these shows, and he's always wanted to do this. And another is a local actor that I have here that's done a few things at the Pewter Plow, and he's just crazy enough to be perfect for these characters. And so we're having a really good time with it. good.
As a director, how do you make sure that they can keep up their energy for however long the play is, 90 minutes or whatever? I mean, energy level must be a major concern.
It is in this play because it's very fast. Costume changes are fast, and they're working hard. You know, we've just been rehearsing for a while to make it easier, and I think their stamina is growing. And I just think as an actor, you find that. There's something about a lot of that will come from the audience, too. You can really feed off an audience's energy. If an audience is enjoying the show, it just makes it even better.
So I imagine you, in terms of costumes and scene changes and whatnot, you have a crew that is more than two, I suppose. A big crew.
I have a great crew backstage. Each actor has their own, own dresser. So they each have one person that kind of follows them around, and another person, handling a lot of the logistics. And then I could not have done this show without Lonnie Zaragoza. I just want to mention Lonnie. Lonnie got very excited about this project, and she had those costumes done in no time. And so she is a real professional, and she has worked a lot with the high school productions here, and she's been amazing. So the costumes are tremendous.
Well, A Tuna Christmas, it's worth it. It sounds like a terrific play. If it's like Greater Tuna, a delight.
It's really fun. And if you saw Greater Tuna, a lot of it's same characters, just different story.
All right, terrific. Let's give people all the details. You have an opening night reception Friday night?
Friday night is sort of a preview.
Oh, okay.
There is an audience. It is tickets are on sale for that. But the official Champagne opening is this Saturday, the 23rd. The Friday and Saturday night performances start at 7:30. There is not a Sunday matinee this first weekend, but after that, in December, there are Sunday matinees at 3 o'clock, and the, those start at 3, the shows start at 7:30, and the phone number, I want to give you the box office phone number at the Pewter Plough Playhouse, which is 927-3877.
927-3877. Mm-hmm. Actually, if you haven't been to the Pewter Plough Playhouse, a member of our audience, it's a very nice theater. It's a very comfortable theater.
Very charming.
Yes.
There's so much charm, and this is sort of a small show in a small venue. It just fits perfectly.
Yeah, it does, absolutely. All right, Jill Turnbow, director of A Tuna Christmas, I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and break a leg.
Thank you.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Larry Rutter. Incidentally, we encourage you to look us up and like us on Facebook at KCBX-FM. I'm going to begin this segment by letting our guest introduce himself.
Well, greetings, Larry. It's great to be with you, and thank you for the opportunity to visit with your listeners. I'm Sam Blakesley. Grew up here in the Central Coast, elementary school, junior high school, community college, and ultimately went on to academia, where I became a research scientist for Exxon and spent a few years in the oil patch out in Texas. Came back to California, got involved in investments and financial planning, and ultimately decided to put my hand to public service and spent, 8 years in the state legislature and the assembly and the Senate, and have now come home and I'm back at San Luis Obispo, involved in a family firm and in a new enterprise out at Cal Poly.
And that enterprise is?
The Institute for Advanced Technology and Public Policy.
Just brand new.
Brand new, absolutely. We've been up and running for less than a year, and we are looking to tackle some of the biggest public policy challenges in the state of California, but doing it a little bit differently. And I'll talk a little about how we're trying to tackle some of these problems. But what's exciting is I'm having the opportunity to do this work out of Cal Poly, working with some really wonderful minds, faculty and students, and the ability to kind of match my background in technology and science, the legislature and public policy, and put them together in a way that hopefully is going to really produce some nice, I think, new ideas on how to solve old problems in California.
When I interviewed you several months or even over a year ago, I was was staggered to find out, I should have addressed you as Dr. Blakesley. You have a PhD in
geological science, did my bachelor's and master's up at Berkeley in geophysics, and I went down to UC Santa Barbara.
So that gives you very good standing in a university community like Cal Poly.
Well, academia is one of my first loves, and it was a very near thing. It was interesting. My father, who's now departed, counseled me as I finished up my program, and I asked him, should I try industry or academia? He sat me down and said, you know, he spent his life in academia, and he really encouraged me to not be afraid to leap into industry, knowing that anything you learn there will only more richly inform what you can bring to students in academia at a later point. And it was good advice for me.
Well, here we are at a later point. Institute for Advanced Technology and Public Policy. What's this mean?
Well, you know, California is a place that is really on the cutting edge. It has been for a long time, and probably at no time more so than today, in large part by virtue of what's happening in the arenas of technology, in Silicon Valley, for example. We are seeing a planet whose population is exploding. The middle class is increasing rapidly. Demands on scarce resources, whether they be water, oxygen, energy, are continuing at a ferocious pace. And we are facing major challenges as to how we create sustainable solutions that will allow us to continue to move people out of poverty, but to do it in a way that doesn't damage or ultimately destroy the environment. And that potentially is where advanced technology can make a real difference. Advanced technology is a leverager. It's a force multiplier. And as we've seen over and over again through history, is a very disruptive force, which can radically change societies and economies in a very short period of time. All of our listeners, of course, are very familiar with the Industrial Revolution, the revolution ultimately that moved us from horse and buggies to automobiles. And we're undergoing a very similar revolution right now with regard to electronics and technology and its implications and applications for education, for open government, for telemedicine, for pharmaceuticals, for a whole host of really big issues. Technology is becoming the essential, indispensable component for how we tackle these problems in a more sustainable way. And the concept here is that these advanced technologies should not only be present in our economy, but should be wholly integrated into how we approach public policy in Sacramento.
You spent some years in Sacramento. Were any of the events that you observed there or were a participant ever, did they ever give you the impetus? Did they give you any of them
absolutely.
For this?
Yes, Larry.
Give me an example.
Well, you know, as I served in the legislature, what I found over and over again is the vast majority of bills that we had to vote on, and we voted on about 5,000 bills every 2 years, if you can believe that. The vast majority of the bills fell in one of two categories. They were either bills that were designed, written, and tailored very narrowly by special interests to advance a particular industry or bargaining unit or position that a special interest had. And I'm not using special interest in a pejorative term. I mean only a singular interest might be a better way to characterize the term. And much of the lobbying and activity in Sacramento was about scope of practice between nurse practitioners and doctors, or differences of opinion on how much wind versus solar might be in the mix when you're looking at renewable energy. And the list goes on and on. Very narrow distinctions where one side or the other in a particular industry would fight for a particular position. That's one category of bills. The other category of bills were ideas that largely came from the legislators themselves that reacted to headlines. Any headline, you know, I remember there was at one point a whale that was stuck in San Francisco Bay that was kind of trolling around and couldn't find its way out. I couldn't believe how much press that darn whale generated. And the politicians lined up right and left to try and save that whale. And that's emblematic of much of the legislation you see in Sacramento. It's reactive to the headlines. And oftentimes the solutions that are proposed are downright silly, but they give the optics or the appearance that someone's trying to do something. And because the vast majority of the bills I saw fell in one of these two categories, As a strategic planner and as a former scientist, I found it extremely frustrating because the big, thoughtful, holistic solutions that weren't driven by a special interest but were driven by informed analysis of a comprehensive solution to a difficult problem were rare. They were the exception, and it was not uncommon to go very long periods of time without seeing those sorts of whole-thinking solutions. So that experience in the legislature caused me to stop and think, well, what is the sort of essential need that we have for better public policy work in California? And the answer came back quite quickly. We need a place where we can develop some of these more thoughtful, far-reaching ideas, but ideas that simply aren't white papers or theoretical or sit in a university environment, but great ideas that have a political overlay that respond to the realities of the efforts and the, I'll call it sort of the outlines and the environment in which you operate when you try and pass legislation.
Mm-hmm. Now, asking a person for a specific example often is a very tricky question to ask, but when you were in Sacramento, was there a particular incident or a particular issue when you thought to yourself, my gosh, if we could marry advanced technology to this, you know, we could really make a difference, and it's not happening?
Well, you know, we had that battle quite frequently on the energy front. Time and again, we'd see that there were smarter, better, faster, cheaper ways to empower local communities or industries or individuals to take responsibility for their own electrical generation. And there are enormous barriers to entry. There are embedded players in the marketplace who frankly don't want or appreciate competition. And the game is largely rigged, which makes it very difficult for people to take responsibility and generate their own electricity in a way that ultimately can be better for the environment and a lower cost to people's pocketbooks. So in the one area where I would say we did, in fact, have some success over the decade that I was involved in some of these policy issues was in this larger question of how can we create a greener economy, more distributed generation, put more power in the hands of individuals to make power decisions. And that has been largely successful. But a area where we did not see success, where advanced technology was fought tooth and nail, was in the education arena. Online learning, distance learning, augmented learning is something that is still very difficult to implement. Governor Brown has been pushing hard for inclusion of technology. We're starting to see an effort to bring in more online textbooks, which is going to, I think, be helpful. But this enhanced learning that integrates the classroom and technology, I think there's a long way for us to go. And the ability to have better metrics, to be able to follow students throughout the course of their career, to understand their strengths and weaknesses over time, those that move from district to district, a better understanding of the best pedagogical methods that teachers are employing. There's a lot of data which could very easily be used to better analyze, understand, and ultimately inform how education, public education, is done in California. And the system has largely been resistant. And that, I think, is a missed opportunity. But I think this next decade, we will see a lot of movement in that arena.
Sam Blakesley is our guest. He is the founding director of the Institute for Advanced Technology and Public Policy at Cal Poly. It was officially announced, I guess, by the president fall, but actually it's about a year old.
It's almost a year old. It's something I'm doing on a pro bono basis. I'm a volunteer out there, but we've been very fortunate to garner the support of some wonderful people. On our board, we have Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. We also have the former chancellor of the community college system, Jack Scott. We have a member of the Public Utilities Commission, Mike Florio, very knowledgeable in energy issues, along with Jim Boyd, who used to serve on the California Energy Commission and worked with the California Air Resources Board. We also have some very bright people in the field of agriculture, Al Motna. And we're building our board literally month by month. We find wonderful people who want to get involved, and we're happy to work with them. So, yes, we are new. We're officially announced in October, and we see a lot of sort of opportunity on the horizon as, you know, more people begin to join this effort.
I'm trying to think of how it works in the university context. Are there courses taught through the Institute? Are there faculty members that are full-time in the Institute? How does that work?
That's a great question. What we do is we go out and seek funding. We have grant applications. We have conversations with donors, raise money to work on projects. And the projects are typically cross-disciplinary and entail putting faculty faculty and students together from multiple colleges. There's a research component and an educational component. The students are learning. They're also getting a little income while they're at Cal Poly. And we're ultimately going to be moving into a model where we begin standing up fellowships that will be paid for all of our projects, and then transferring this knowledge into a classroom setting and use as case studies the research projects we do to pass on the learnings to next generations of students. So we have sort of a multi-tiered approach toward the Institute and its work. And these beginning phases are mostly focused on the research so that we can begin standing up examples of advanced technology impacting public policy, which can then be used in an educational environment to help in the classroom.
And we're talking with Sam Blakesley, the Institute for Advanced Technology and Public Policy. I somehow have a problem. I have to have it written in front of me to understand.
No, that's okay.
It.
And I was told it was a very injudicious choice of names or monikers because it did not it was not conveniently turned into an acronym that would fit on a flyer. So, not having a marketing background, I will acknowledge maybe I need a little more help in that arena.
Politics is marketing. Don't kid us. Advanced technology does beg the question of what technology is advanced and what isn't. I imagine it's a rather gray line between the two. People have been applying technology to public policy in one form or another for a long time, but some of the more advanced technologies,
well,
the Silicon Valley, the environmental technologies.
You bring up a good point. I mean, what is advanced today won't be perceived as being very advanced 30 years from now. The interesting thing about government is any technology you introduce is likely to be advanced compared to what they're using today. It's kind of the nature of government, which has a very difficult time embracing new technologies and oftentimes is deeply invested in old legacy technologies. And as we're seeing in Washington today, the ability to quickly bring in fairly routine technologies that are being used widely in the private sector can be enormously challenging when dealing in a government setting, in part because of the contracting rules. There's a lot of reasons for that. Mm-hmm. But it's always been challenging for government to be a first adopter or even a timely adopter of advanced technology.
It seems to me that you could make the case that the problems that we're seeing now with Obamacare have a lot to do with the top political and administrative leaders not embracing, not fully understanding what the implications were for the advanced technology that they were saddled with.
And there used to be a time back in the House of Representatives when they had a resident on staff technology experts, which helped advise on big bills to make sure that some of these integration issues were addressed in the legislation.
The Office of Technology Assessment. I think that was the name of it. I'll be darned. Memory brings it out of my dim past.
Well, and there's an example where a little cost cutting may be penny wise and pound foolish.
That's right. You do have some ongoing projects now in your press release. You talked about three of them, Digital Democracy, California Energy Initiative, and the Connect Academy. Take one of those and
sure.
make us excited about it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about digital democracy. We're currently facing an environment where people are becoming increasingly cynical and frustrated with what's happening up in Sacramento. If you read the papers, you'll see that there are enormous scandals. The FBI is investigating offices. Files are being carted out for examination. And lobbyists seem to have enormous influence. Digital democracy operates under the principle that sunshine is the best disinfectant. And this program is creating a software tool available to the public at large, but also can be used by investigative journalists to do something that folks have wanted to do for a long time, but there hasn't been a technology available to facilitate this activity, and it is to readily and easily search the spoken word in a video. Now, let me see if I can rephrase that. Currently, if you sit down in front of your computer and you go to Google or Bing or some other search engine, you can type in pretty much any word you want or any combination of words with ands or ors and do an advanced search. And it's amazing what you can find. The hits that pop up would have otherwise taken hours in the library to research. And you can refine your search and you can click on a variety of different hits that come up and drill down until you find exactly what you want, literally in a fraction of the time you would if you'd gone to a library. We do not have a similar tool to search the spoken word. Imagine, if you will, that you remembered in your distant memory that you'd heard an interesting comment on Meet the Press a couple of years ago from a person you had in mind, and you wanted to find out what exactly was it that person said that you thought you remembered because it was important to you. Maybe you're writing an article. The amount of work you'd have to do to go find that old tape, if you will, go through it literally and listen and listen and listen with headphones on until you finally found the place, if you could, where the person was speaking, and then listen carefully to see if, in fact, they said what you thought they did say, well, could take days and maybe longer still. A tool like this would allow you to take any stream of video and make it immediately accessible for a search so that you could type in a keyword, a speaker, a phrase, an issue, and just as Google does, all the hits would immediately pop up. Now, the data we're using to create this tool is the recordings that happen in the legislature. There's something like 130 committees up in Sacramento, as I mentioned before, upwards of 5,000 bills every 2 years are put into print. And what folks don't realize is that there is no transcript, there are no minutes, there is no specific record of anything that is said during all of these committee hearings. It's rather shocking because you'll be in a committee room with half a dozen legislators, and you'll look out in the audience, and there will be not a soul from the public, but you'll see 30, 35, 40 lobbyists all lined up, ready to provide testimony on how we as legislators should vote on a particular bill. And it occurred to me as I sort of reflected on this, how powerful it would be if the public could immediately access and search in a Google-like format, what did this lobbyist say? What did that legislator say? Why was that bill amended in committee? What was the debate between the three or four parties that were vehemently and vociferously pounding the table and arguing for this amendment versus that amendment? All that information is currently lost. All you know is the form of the bill on the way in and the form of the bill on the way out, with none of the discussion or dialogue that'll help you understand who is pushing for what in Sacramento. We're also looking at adding a feature which would allow you to identify speakers and also link them up with the campaign contributions they have received or that they have given if they happen to be the lobbyist. So we see this tool as potentially transformative. We're going to set it up in such a way that you can pull clips off that you like when you do your search, take the clips and put it in your social media, send it out to your Facebook friends, if you will, with your commentary and urging them to contact their legislator or whatever the appropriate action is. So we see this as a tool that, as we get stood up and implemented, will be a powerful way to connect the average person who can't drive to Sacramento to sit in a hearing to understand what is exactly is being done in their name, then also give them ability to take action.
Is there any activity now going on in a research capacity at Cal Poly that you've identified early on that might have a major public policy impact but hasn't, and your institute might marry the two?
Well, you know, one of the issues that we are exploring, and I know others at Cal Poly are exploring as well, in the engineering department in particular, is this question of cybersecurity. We're increasingly finding out, as we saw with the recent NSA scandal, that our records are nowhere near as private as we thought they once were. Now, when it comes to government snooping, I think most of us are fairly confident we don't have anything that is very interesting to scrutinize. But not all intrusion in electronic systems are without threat. And I'm talking beyond the threat of a loss of privacy. As we saw with the Stuxnet virus a couple of years ago, there's now the capacity to build very specialized viruses and systems that operate almost as weapons. And they're designed to go into the public space and work their way through machine after machine after machine until they find just the machine that they are built to find. At each step, they delete themselves so they won't leave any fingerprints or any footprints. And then when these viruses find their way into controllers for centrifuges, for example, which was the situation in Iran, or potentially into very delicate control equipment that is operating refineries that are oftentimes located in populated areas, it's not too difficult to envision a situation in the future where the type of cybersecurity questions we face are quite grave and deal where there are failures in dealing with cybersecurity in billions of costs and lost lives. So this question of how to get our hands around this larger question of controlling privacy and security in the arena of technology is enormous. And there are a number of people out of Cal Poly that are beginning to look at this very seriously. The Department of Defense is looking at it very seriously. Our utilities, especially those that operate nuclear power plants, are very sensitive to the question of the security of their systems. And so we can imagine a day when this could become an issue that, like our Apollo effort or Manhattan effort, will require an enormous investment of resources to address a problem in the aftermath of a crisis. So I would say that is sort of a cutting-edge issue that people in Cal Poly are thinking about very deeply.
It's very exciting. Your institute is very exciting. I wish you the absolute best, Sam Blakesley, the Institute for Advanced Technology and Public Policy. You've got your first year under your belt. I look for great things in the future.
Thank you, Larry. It's great to visit with you, and it's wonderful to see you again.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I've been delighted to be your host this week. I'm Larry Rutter.